pro boxing's, especially 12 round fights, it slows down after 5-6 rounds. Mm-hmm. So him jumping about and being all that, he's going to get caught at some point and he's going to get hurt. I was like, wow, where's this kid come from? He reminded me, he was like a white Riddick Bowe.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He could fight inside and his ring savvy was, yeah, you could see there's something about him, definitely. He'd have me doing 12 rounds of shadow boxing and I was just hating 12
threes.
12 threes of shadow boxing. And I was like, oh my God. And he'd watch you and he'd be all over you and you think, oh my God, this is dreadful. Dreadful.
Hello and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tristix.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
I still get goosebumps to this day.
you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's beating me. He said, well, let's pull him back.
In the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
There's winning and there's nothing else.
Hello and welcome back to Boxing Life Stories. My guest this week is Manchester lightweight Lee Meagher. Well, I say Manchester, but Lee actually made a lot of his bones down south. During my early years at Boxing News, the office was not far away from Alan Lacey's Real Fight Club, and quite often I would head down there during my lunch break to watch the pros training and spar, and I'd spend time with the fighters and the trainers. As we talk about in this podcast, there was Rob McCracken who was there with the likes of Carl Froch, Darren Barker, Lenny Dawes and Lee Meagher. And Brian Lawrence was there with Darren Sutherland, Ian Napper, Anthony Small. And there was always Spencer Fear in there. Tony Salam was around. And it was also there where I saw the Cubans, Luis Garcia and Mike Perez for the first time. And they made a real impression on me. Anyway, Lee has not become a recluse, but he's not the easiest guy to track down these days. So I was thrilled to get the opportunity to spend some time with him recently. It had been a long time since we'd been in touch. And Lee always was a really good guy to get along with, a good guy to interview. And he was a heck of a fighter too. Lee works as a tarmacker now. He was an honest fighter. He's an honest worker, a blue collar guy and really good company. And I really enjoyed spending time with him. He was obviously a part of that famous Mick Hennessy crop, the class of 2000 with the likes of Carl Froch, Matthew Thirlwell, David Walker, and then we would get to Tyson Fury and many others from that group. It was high profile at the time. I'm not sure if you remember the Boxing News adverts where they would basically rip off film posters and feature the guys. And it was all really, really good, clever stuff. Before we get to Lee, let me just say a huge thanks to those of you who are on my Patreon page, patreon.com/TrisDixon. You get episodes ahead of time up there. There are episodes up there with the likes of Sam Sexton, Danny McIntosh, and now American matchmaker Eric Botcher are all up there with more to be added in the next week or so. Huge thanks to you guys. You guys make a huge difference to me, so I'm really grateful for the support. And huge thanks to my sponsors, Hanson Lee Resourcing, were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. And not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but Hanson Lee, Blaz and the gang, such a cool team. They help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety. Derek Andrews and his team are a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide. They offer expert, impartial advice on all aspects of fire, health and safety compliance. And you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. Huge thanks to my sponsors. Huge thanks to those on Patreon. And here is the brilliant Lee Meagher. Lee, thanks for coming down. I was actually scratching my head. I can't remember even the last time I saw you. Probably last time you fought.
Probably, yeah. Might be, I don't know. I can't remember who I saw then. I got a bit behind
it,
didn't I?
It might have been, maybe I did see you at the Froch Groves fight behind the scenes.
Yeah, maybe there.
Because Rob was using you to see the other side get bandaged.
Yeah, yeah.
So you and Rob's still in touch years down the line?
Yeah. Come to a wedding and I went to his wedding. And yeah, we're still good friends. I speak to his brothers, Max, Spencer and that, and yeah.
But you're out of the limelight big time. Like, you know, you don't put your two bobs worth in social media much.
No, only when I'm half cut, to be honest with you. I should come with a PIN number on my Facebook and stuff. But yeah, no, I don't. I spend my time as a family man, like, just working and just providing for them, really.
What's work?
I'm a tarmacker. I've done it since I turned pro, to be honest with you. I'm a bit different now. I've been site managing for the last 10 years, but I've been working on freelance, and that's it, really. I've just started to pick up bits and bobs of work myself now as well. So
when you say you've been doing it all that time, was this what you expected after boxing, that you would go back to doing it?
Yeah, I did it all within 5 days of the Danny Hunt fight, and it's just something I've always done. Like, I've enjoyed working. I'm not an idiot. I knew I wasn't going to be a millionaire. I knew I wasn't going to be a world champion or whatever, but so I'd always got my head on that I was going to work, and that's what I've carried on doing, really.
I mean, it's you say that, but lots of people do think that. Lots of people do think they're the ones that are going to be, you know, retired at 35,
yeah,
millions in the bank.
You've got to be realistic, though. I mean, what is it, 5% of the boxing come out with any sort of money? I wasn't
or
of that standard.
Maybe just five.
Yeah,
five people.
Yeah, yeah. I back myself against anyone. I was never short of confidence. I'm not saying that. Certain things I just knew I wasn't going to be that person.
Interesting. Do you miss it?
I miss fighting. Yeah, I miss fighting. I don't think you can ever replace that. It's tough when you're good. Never mind when you're getting beat. So it come to a point where I was like, I probably could have gone on a little bit longer, but I don't think I think the Faxton fight that took everything out of me as a fighter. Like,
did you come off the rails in retirement?
Or
did you just get your head down?
I didn't really have time to be honest with you. I met my wife within a month, and then I sort of enjoyed myself, and then went from there, and then we had kids within 6 months. Well, not six, she was pregnant within 6 months. So it was a case of carrying on with that. But what's going off the rails, you know, it goes off in different ways, doesn't it? You know, some people go off and might be going on drinking sessions for 2 or 3 weeks and whatever, but sometimes we have our moments. I'm not going to lie to you. It's the same for every fighter, I suppose.
Did you go through a depressive period when you stopped fighting?
Listen, I've got mouths to feed. I haven't got time to have an ego and say I'm not doing this, I'm not doing that. I have my moments like any normal man does, really. Working man, trying to provide for his family. I do have my moments, yeah. I think...
Is it linked to do with the acceptance of the loss of the identity and that kind of stuff? The loss of...
Taking a loss is always... not that bad if you've put everything into it. It's when you've half cut it and you should have won, you know. Listen, everyone's got the cross to bear, aren't they? So obviously there's things what go on in everyone's upbringing and stuff like that, what can give you bad days and stuff like that. But I move forward. I miss fighting. I miss the crack with the lads. But life moves on, doesn't it?
Because when you and I saw each other a lot, it was back in the days of the Real Fight Club, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And so
yeah,
you were there. So just paint the picture, because it was a great, for me, that was a great period of time for me. I was like,
yeah, you was. I remember you was up and coming journalist. Like, I do remember, and you used to be always with Brian Lawrence,
yeah,
Ian Napper, and that. Good lads.
So obviously we had this gym, which people probably don't either remember or didn't know who was there at the time, but there was you. Thirlwall was there on and off.
David Walker.
Yeah, Carl Froch was down there. Yeah. Darren Barker.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, Brian Lawrence was there with Napa, Anthony Small and Darren Sutherland, wasn't he?
Yeah, because we all trained at the Lennox Lewis Club before that. And Panos, who owned the building, had sold it. So we all moved over from there. Spent a lot of time with Ian Napa and Brian Lawrence. Great people, great boxing people. And when Robert wasn't there, I used to go on the runs with him and train with him at the Pedro Club and stuff with James Cook and all that there. You know, so it was like natural progression that we all went over there together.
And so I saw you do loads of rounds with Napa in the back in the day.
Yeah. He's a great fighter. Great characters.
Because he sparred like he fought, didn't he? He was the same. Yeah, he was doing sort of the Mayweather stuff
he did. But Ian will tell you himself, his hardest thing was, you know, discipline. But he was great fighter. And I think Brian, if he'd have met Brian a lot earlier in his career, I think he would have been one of the best.
Yeah, because he was a top international amateur, wasn't he? Yeah. Tip for really big things.
Yeah, massive. And rightly so. He was a good lad. Good lad.
So how did you get into boxing in the first place? What was your route to
just from friends. My uncle boxed, but it was me who got him into it, and it was a little bit like that. And
did he box pro or just amateur?
No, amateur. I didn't really take it serious as a kid. Schoolboys and stuff like that, but nothing really. I didn't really have much coaching as such. And then I left home at 19 and moved to Jersey. Lived out in Jersey for 3 years, and the coach out there was pretty militant, and he said, you either do it or you don't do it. And we went for it, and I got to ABA final the first year and lost to Dazza Williams.
God, that's random, going out to Jersey. What took you out there?
My uncle, same uncle.
Okay. What part of Jersey were you in then?
I lived in
St Helier?
St Helier's the town centre. I lived in St Wands at the start, and then I ended up in St Helier.
Yeah.
My uncle lived out there. He moved out there with his wife at the time.
Did you like it out there?
I loved it. And I represented Jersey for the Commonwealth Games in 98 in Kuala Lumpur after getting to the final against Dazza Williams. But yeah, it was a great place. And I've still got friends out there and some good fighters out there. Some good kids.
What were the Commonwealths like?
It was good. But I was tired of the weight. I boxed at featherweight at the time. I was only 19. I just grew that too much. And the sleeping out there, I just couldn't sleep. It was, I'm not one for jet lag and all that, really.
So did you feel different in the ring out there?
I got done in the first round by David Lowry. I was running on the day of the fight to make weight and stuff like that. You're just a little schoolboy errors you're making it, but that's life.
How many amateur fights did you have, do you know?
I'd like to say about 60-odd. 65, 66.
So you had a few over in Jersey, and then you came back over here.
Yeah, ABA final, 98, lost to Dazza Williams. 99, I moved up to lightweight. I lost to Stephen Burke. And then the next year, I got to the semi-finals, and I lost to Colin Toohey in the semi-finals. But I'd sort of outgrown the amateurs. And with sparring out there, it was very few and far between. The best year I had was when the fights come thick and fast.
Yeah.
I think it was 2000. They'd been put back into the summer or something like that. So I didn't have many fights that year. But not taking away that, I got beat in the semi-final, so it is what it is.
And then, but you working in Jersey, by the way. Did you have jobs?
Yeah, I did a bit of all sorts. Building sites, worked in clothes shops. At the time, I think it was a scaffolder. Took a job on the scaffolding the week before I fought Stephen Burke, to be honest with you, which was crazy if you look back now. Crazy. But there you go. It's one of them.
Got to make it pay, haven't you?
Yeah, it was one of them. You didn't really take it for granted where you was and what you should have been doing. You should have been resting up, really.
What were your parents doing? Because you were clearly close with your uncle. Were your parents around?
They both separated when I was about five. My mum married again, and my dad married again. Yeah, that was it. I got a half brother and a half sister.
Were you close to them? Did you stay close to them?
Yeah, yeah.
Were they all for you fighting?
Yes. My dad and all, that was all of them. Brought my half sister up. My dad's brother, he was at all my fights. He was one of them who come all over. They was from Newbury that way. So yeah, it was close with them.
And when you turned pro, how did you go about selecting the team and who you were going to work with, manager, promoter, trainer?
I'd got quite friendly with Dave Walker out in the Commonwealths because he was there with England, kept in contact with him. And originally, I'd set my stall out to turn pro with Brian Hughes at Collyhurst.
Right.
And that was through a friend, through someone. And then I got involved with Dave Walker and Mickey Hennessy. And after speaking to Mickey Hennessy, and I don't even remember him at the time, he was a breath of fresh air like at the time for the programme. He'd come in the game, and I think he definitely changed it in a good way for fighters like.
So, because at different points during your pro career, you were part of Mick Hennessy's poster campaign.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Which was great, right?
Yeah.
You must have loved doing that stuff. Which ones were you part of? Do you remember?
All of them. We did them all.
The Trainspotting one?
Trainspotting one. The Christmas one with the Christmas trees covering our privates and all that.
The Reservoir Dogs one?
Yeah. Yeah, well, that was the first one, wasn't it? But Mickey he had an eye for stuff, in fairness to him. He had a proper eye for...
Did you speak to other people? Did you speak to Maloney, Warren?
No. I didn't, know. They come out to... For some reason, Dave and Mickey was out in Jersey. But there must have been a select team out there, and I boxed a kid from Northern Ireland, but boxed out of Guernsey. And they was there, and I kept in contact with them, and that was it. I made my mind up. He just something about him. And a little bit naive, I suppose, like, but there you go.
I don't know. I mean, it wasn't a bad selection, was it?
Fantastic. Yeah. I'll be honest with you. I would never have been a British champion without Mick Hennessy and Robert McCracken. Robert and was just they looked after me because I didn't grasp it straight away. I think when I was there, I could have held it my own with anyone, but I could have gone and done a lot of potholes on the way through. Definitely.
So, who was the first? What was the first meeting with Rob? Do you remember?
Robert was still fighting at the time, and Mickey was obviously managing us. He was good pals with Robert, and I'd met him a couple of times. I remember going to the Holmes fight.
Oh, the Keith Holmes fight.
Yeah, I was in the changing rooms there. But it's ironic because we was in a limo on the way to the fight with them all, and I was like, well, I was in the stands when Foster fought Robert. And with the Salford fans, like, because that's where we were brought up and all that. And we was all there, and I'm like, I'm with all yous lot now. It was crazy, like, but they're good lads, good set of lads.
So you got to tell me about that then, the Foster McCracken night. Tell me about it. What was your view? Like, were you a little hooligan? Were you in the midst of it all?
No. No. It was crazy because we went from the, I can't remember the name of the pub. Of the Weast, I think it was the Weast. My uncle, obviously, was in and around you for Steve, because Steve lived in Jersey for a while.
Right.
Because he was a bricklayer by trade. And he knew my uncle and other uncle as well. So we used to go and watch Steve quite a bit, like, and obviously this fight come up, and we all got on a coach from the Weast, and it was scary for a 16-year-old lad, I've got to be honest, like. The uplifted every off-licence you would see. Every bit of booze, and then they got there, and it was dodging chairs and all sorts. It was.
What
it
did
was,
you see? Like literally chairs being thrown.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Tearing into each other, groups tearing into each other.
Yeah, it was set up like, but it was. They rough tough sort of fellas, like, you know, they weren't there.
Carnage.
Yeah, yeah.
You weren't tempted to go in.
No. We my uncle dragged me to one side, and we ended up getting a taxi home from Birmingham at the time. Which you weren't best pleased about paying all that money, like, but it was obviously the right thing to do.
So, did you get good sparring in the amateurs? I know you said obviously it was a bit scarce in Jersey, but were there some guys that you did spar with through the amateurs, or did you spar with any pros when you were younger that you got some good experience with?
I did a bit. Obviously, my uncle did a bit of fighting. He was a decent level. Michael Carruth come to Jersey, believe it or not, and I was just amateur, and I did a bit of sparring with him, but that was about it.
It's pretty notable, though.
Yeah, oh, God, he took his time with me, he held me up, to be honest with you. I was only a kid, 19, he obviously was Olympic champion at the time. I think he was fighting, the mixed race kid from Bristol who boxed out in America.
Adrian Stone.
Yeah, he was fighting him at the time. And he was supposed to fight for the WBO fighter. But he was good. Good fighter.
So, but when you came back and you were in the UK, well, I suppose what was the decision behind turning pro? What did you think? And what were you, what was, did Mick sell you a dream? Or are you saying, look, I want to get to the British title level? What was the goal?
I don't know. I just sort of ran with it, to be honest with you. Obviously, British title was what I aimed for. Like, it was something I'd set my star light. I thought, you know, see how I go. I just went with there. It was a natural progression, innit, it, from amateur, and that I'd outgrown Jersey and the amateurs. I needed to go on that one bit further and turn pro.
So did you start down in Hackney at the Lennox First Gym? That was the start?
Yeah.
So what was that like, those days, being down
it
there?
It was good, because Jimmy Tibbs was running it then.
Right.
So you had all Jimmy's fighters in there, Wayne Alexander, Steve Murray, Jason Rowlands, I can't remember much. There was loads in there. It was. It weren't Jimmy Tibbs. It was Dean Powell at the time.
Okay.
He was still running for Panos because he wasn't with Maloney at the time, because they separated at the time after. So it was a great gym. Mickey come on board up there. We used to spar up there. We had a fella called George Wadman who was helping out Mickey at the time with the coaching, because Robert wasn't. He was still fighting at the time. So yeah, we did the rounds in London, like, you know, we. All the different gyms and Peacock and other places. Sparring.
So who was training you before Rob officially became full?
Yeah, it was George Wadman, who did bits for Matthew Barney and a few other pros. He was helping out, and then Robert come on board when he was still doing his bits and bobs before and doing the corner work, but obviously he was still fighting.
And as soon as Rob took on training, did you buy into him straight away? Because
I think you don't have to talk to Robert to realise that. Do you got to listen? Like, you know what I mean? He has that sort of authority. I think anyway. And I've seen a lot of the trainers in the gyms, and you know, respectful, like, but I think Robert is different class. Like,
what is it about him that sets him apart? Because like you say, he. When he talks, you've got to listen. You tune in.
But he's just intelligent in the way he talks, and he sees things. You know, he work the head with you and say things, and you know, he's just the way he is. He challenge you, and he's a nice man.
I remember watching him coaching you fellas, and the one thing that surprised me was how he'd always pick up on your shadow boxing. Mm. Do you know what, you know, he'd be very intricate with instructions, wouldn't he?
Yeah, it's something that, obviously, coming from an amateur sort of background, and it's, you know, a lot of gyms don't really concentrate on that. And I'm not just saying this for myself, like, he'd have me doing 12 rounds of shadow boxing, and I was just hating
12 threes.
12 threes of shadow boxing. And I was like, oh my God. And he'd watch you and he'd be all over you. And you think, oh my God, this is dreadful. Dreadful. But he spent years in gyms watching, you know, all good fighters in Birmingham. He said he watched Donald Curry come over. I forget who. It might have been the Colin Jones fight. I'm not too sure. And he just watched him shadow boxing. And he spent hours just shadow boxing. And then he went to America to work with Thel Torrance, and he spent time out there, and he knows his stuff.
Yeah, and obviously what he's doing there is trying to instill good habits, right? So they become
second nature. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Did you realise that at the time, or did you just think he was being a pain in the ass?
I'll be honest with you. My early start of it, I was just glad I weren't sparring, to be honest with you, because I was getting filled in. It was a respite for me, to be honest with you, because at the time we had Dave Walker, and there was a Leo O'Reilly. Now, I boxed Leo as an amateur, and I stopped him in two rounds. But then, obviously, time goes on, and it was probably a year later, and he's obviously one of Mickey's fighters, and he's a light welterweight. And he just got it straight away. So sparring for me was dreadful, because obviously I'm boxing someone, sparring with someone I'd fought already and beat, and I'm getting turned over every day. So it was a respite. It was shadow boxing, to be honest with you.
Who else were you sparring down in that Lennox Lewis gym then?
Colin Dunn. Thousands of rounds with Colin Dunn.
Really?
Yeah. And he's definitely sets his star like Colin. Like he
comes to fight.
Yeah, he's good old school fighter, and you know, him and Colin Lake were great partnership, real good partnership, good people. I'd learned a lot from Colin.
Was there a point where it changed, where you actually started to enjoy the sparring?
Yeah. Certain things, pinnacle things happen in your life and you sort of go, right, hang on, you're not really doing what you should be doing here, and everything changes. And it just sort of turned. I used to spar with Tonsil Tonchev, who obviously a European champion and
Bulgarian
all.
Bulgarian kid, yeah.
Yeah, and he stayed at the gym because obviously Panos managed him. And he fought just a couple of weeks before he fought for the European title, and I handed him his arse, and it was like, actually, I'm doing all right here now, do you know what I mean? And obviously, tides turn, it's age and stuff like that, and I started doing better against Colin, because he just walked through everyone, Colin, like, he was an animal. And then all of a sudden, you're holding your own, and you're like, actually, it gives you that bit of confidence to say, actually, you're not that bad.
You know, you're a long way from home down there. Firstly, are you coming back to Salford on and off, or are you just full-on moved down there?
I just moved down there, like I say. I moved from there from Jersey. So yeah. I moved straight from London from Jersey to London. And I come back home, you know, at, what, 2 years after retiring, a year after retiring.
Oh, so you stayed down there the entire time?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I lived there.
So the next question is about the guys that were down there. Obviously, you, David, Matthew Thirlwell and stuff. Are you guys good, diligent trainers, or are you party guys who like to go out?
I was never a party guy, but I probably could have done a lot more better. And I'll never forget Robert saying to me, he said, you don't want it enough. And I was looking at him thinking, I'm living in a bedsit in Hackney. And I'm thinking, I don't want it enough. I'm miles away from home. But he was right, because I weren't running the right runs. I weren't running the right things.
What do you mean by that? Like, as in you?
Yeah, I didn't. I wasn't hungry enough. I fought Danny Hunt for the English title, and I double shifted probably within a week of the fight, and it was working here and working there, and you got to go without you. Any fighter, any athlete, they've got to put everything into that. You can't have no backup plans. And he was right in what he said. But at the time I was like thinking, but I'm here, I'm doing everything that I should be doing. But obviously that's experience in life, isn't it?
But it's a difficult one though, isn't it? Because if you'd fully invested in boxing and put everything else, you know, not even to one side, but didn't do anything else, then you wouldn't have anything now.
No, I mean, it makes no odds, I suppose. At the time, I still come away with not much, apart from, like, obviously working. I did work and stuff like that, but, yeah, I think he was right. I think, and you've got to set your goals out. I think it's got to be all or nothing. I think I probably should have, you know, go without the nice clothes or go without this right stuff, and everything's got to be about fighting and training. Any athlete, what does any less? I mean, you get what you deserve in whatever you do, especially in fighting. You reach your level no matter what, whether it's through your training or your talent.
I was speaking to Tommy McDonough about this, actually, and he was saying there was a spell there where he sort of beat a journeyman by a point and then drew with a couple of guys that he probably should have beaten. And he's like, well, it just reflected what was going on.
100%. And you get all these lads and fighters, and they'll keep going, and some will achieve more than what they should have. And I'm a prime example of that. I definitely achieved more than what I thought I could achieve. But in an instance, I probably could have made super featherweight. I probably could have done that extra running, could have done that extra dieting. But that's life, isn't it?
You fought Peter Buckley on your debut.
Yeah. I think I was the first one to ever do it at the time as well, I think. Yeah, it was a bit of a shock, to be honest with you. I got told a lot about Peter. He's a great character and a good fighter.
Did you learn stuff?
God,
what was it like being in there with a guy who'd had, I think only back then, only about 200 fights?
Yeah, just about, yeah. And he come out and he threw a massive wide left hook straight at me, and I was like, whoa, what's going on here? And it didn't help with Nobby Nobbs shouting at me from the corner, saying my lace was undone. Or Billy Aird, who was a referee at the time, saying that I had a small nick above my eye, and he said, if it gets any worse, I'm going to have to stop it. And I was like, look at it, was you joking? I'd never have a cut in my life, and it was a bit of a wake up call. Like,
how did you So in terms of Rob, do you know specifically when he came on and that you started working with him?
I think might have been 4 or 5 fights into it.
Did that, do you know if that changed your mindset once yeah. he was there yeah. full time?
Yeah, I know. A lot of it was obviously his time with him, but boxing's not, sometimes not about what you do in the gym, it's what you do out of the gym, isn't it?
Yeah.
The runs in the morning, the not eating is right shite. That's I think that's what makes the difference. The small margins is definitely everything.
Yeah, because if you're only in the gym a couple of hours a day,
that's what I mean. He can't live, and that's where probably David and Matthew will tell you they probably went wrong in their lives.
So you had this tried and tested route of fighting the likes of Billy Smith and Jason Nesbitt, right?
Yeah.
Which, go on, why is that funny?
No. It was just, no, the good fighters. Yeah. Billy Smith, he was aggro. Nesbitt could punch. But like I said before, without Mickey and Robert, they steer you the right way, you know.
Well, and then you got steered into Carl Allen, and that should have been a yeah. straightforward assignment.
Well, not, it is if you prepare and you run and you do the diligent things you do. But
so is this the first point in your pro career where you're like, okay, I'm going to have to buckle up a little bit more because I've
yeah, like you say, it's things in your life, what you know, change things, you know. And Carl Allen gave me, it was a welcome to pro boxing, without a doubt. And he could fight and could punch.
Yeah.
And I don't know, that was a proper wake-up call.
What did you leave that night thinking, you know, after, you know, you had, well, now the blemish on your
I think I might have said to Robert, I don't know if I'm made up for this game. I don't know if I'm... Because amateur boxing and pro boxing is two different sports, you know. It's a bit different now because you've got GB, so you've got these men in there, whereas, especially lightweights and stuff like that, they're not really men. You're still like 18, 19, 20, 21. After that, you're pro. Yeah. So I tend to think amateur was more like a youth sport, I suppose, than amateurs, especially at the lower weights. And obviously, you turn pro and big-eyed men, aren't they? You know what I mean?
So it's fed to the wolves.
It's
sink or swim, isn't it?
Well, it's sink or swim, and that's what's probably good about the sport now. You know, you've got to fight people, and that's what Matchroom, I suppose. Matchroom are pretty good on that one. It's, well, there was a years ago, like you fight. You got, if you can fight, you got to fight someone.
So you fought again people like Arv Mitu, Buckley again, who you fought a second time.
Yeah,
I think you might have fought them for three times.
Yeah,
right?
Three times. Yeah, yeah.
And then Nesbitt. What's it like being in with these guys? Then are they tough men? And do you think that they're waiting for you to try and take a liberty with them so that they can mess you around?
Or yeah,
are they compliant to a certain degree?
Yeah, they're not. They're not stupid, are they? Let's be honest. And you, if there's cameras there, they're even more cuter, you know. But, I mean, I've got to say, I mean, I'd had an injury between all these fights, so it was a case of fighting them. I got so, then I fractured my elbow, and then I took a bit of time out, and then come back and fought these lads again. But, you know, like I say, until I grasp it, grow up the game, like, it's something that there was a needs and must at the time, definitely.
So when you beat Carl Allen in the rematch, is that a question of you finding that, you know, if you don't cut corners,
yeah,
be better?
Yeah, of course. And it's the same in anything, isn't it? I think definitely it was a point where I thought, right, well, you've got to do this proper now. And like I say, Carl could fight, and he was definitely up for it.
And you beat Charlie Shepherd, and that was in many ways your first proper step up, right?
Yeah, yeah. Another good fighter, you know. Probably a bit past his best as such, but still a good tough fighter, and it was a good fight. I think he stopped with a nose injury, broken nose or something like that.
But that's matchmaking, isn't it? You get the names of the guys. Oh no, on the way
listen,
down,
meet and Tom Boobin
to the
yeah, 100%, yeah. And he fought Boom Boom Johnson. He was a British champion. He was super featherweight. He's a proper handful.
So you mentioned Danny Hunt. So it was your first. That was your fight. You fought him for the English title.
Yes. Yeah.
And
yeah.
It was your first loss.
It was. Yeah. Bit controversial, I'll be honest with you. I thought I won the fight. It was the first fight that Mickey Hennessy and Frank Warren. Mickey was the new one on the scene, and Frank Warren won. Frank Maloney at the time won the purse bids, and it was a little bit controversial. I think. Well, I thought
so
it won.
You went on an away show.
Yeah, it was at Your Call. Yeah,
was that tough? Were you treated like an away fighter? Did you feel? Yeah. Like that?
Yeah, I don't. Just... Nothing really phases me like that. I'll be honest with you. I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, they had a press conference at the Hilton, and I went on my own. And as Robert said, "You're all right, go on your own." I went, "Yeah, all right." But they knew what they was doing. They was playing mind games with everyone. So I turned up to the press conference. Big press. I think Julius Francis was the top of the bill. So it was a big press conference, and I'm on my own. And you could see that. They couldn't get their head round it. That there was no one else there to help me, like, or to be with me. So it was a.
What was it like from your perspective? Was it intimidating, did you know why?
I didn't really take it on. I didn't take it on board, really. I'd probably be a little bit naive to it. I was like, yeah, no problem, because it didn't really faze me, to be honest with you.
It doesn't change what happens on fight night, does it?
Not really. No, no. It's all a lot of rubbish, isn't it? Yeah.
So you return with a good win over Martin Watson, and a couple of fights later you fight Dave Stewart. I'm guessing you knew Dave pretty well, right?
Yeah, I sparred with Dave. I sparred quite a bit with Dave, and he was a nice kid. Yeah, he was a good lad. He actually caught me in sparring once, and I played that my elbow would hurt, but I couldn't feel my legs, I'll be honest with you. So, it was good fire. Martin Watson, good fire, good tough fire, real hard case.
Have you stayed in touch with any of these guys?
Dave Stewart might randomly message him or something like that. Or
did he move away? He went to Thailand?
Yeah, I think so. He passed out as a black cab driver. Okay. And he lives a single life, I think. He goes around and does what he wants, I think. But nice, real nice fella, Dave.
So tell me about you and Rob. Do you get as much time from him when you're fighting as you want, and when you're in the gym, do you feel like?
Yeah.
Because obviously the stable's big and growing. Yeah. Frotch is moving up the ladder, Barker's moving up the ladder. But from what I saw, everyone got what they needed out of him, right?
Yeah. I mean, Darren was pretty much with Tony Sims. Carl, yeah. But I was always at his. Whether he was it was your hour or whatever like that, or it was your turn to train. I spent a lot of time with him outside of the gym. Just that's enough, you know what I mean? At the time, I was fanatical about boxing.
Yeah.
And that's all I wanted to do. I'd even go to Liverpool Street Station to buy the boxing news on a Thursday because I knew they would put it on the shelves on the Thursday instead of the Friday. So I loved the game. So being around Robert, and we was in the same digs at the time, it was everything to me. I mean, everything I owe to me, his career, to my career is from him, like.
What are some of the things he taught you, and did he teach you sort of life lessons as well as stuff in the boxing? Are there a couple of things that stand out, or a couple of bits of advice, or
I don't know,
things that you can easily recall that he shared with you?
I know. Yeah, he was. Yeah, I can't really remember. I remember he was just a proper man's man. So you know what I mean. Whatever he said, he was his. You know, he was a. He's a good man. He's a good man.
It's funny, though, because obviously when you say someone's a man's man, in the current climate...
Well, you can't say it, can you?
Well, you kind of can, but also it kind of means that they are... That the issue of mental health is dead to them. Do you know what I mean?
Well...
Because when you say they're a man's man, you kind of think, oh, they'll just grizz it out regardless.
Yeah, I don't... Yeah, maybe. But like I say, you know... There's been times where we've talked, you know, on a personal level, and he said, you know, he's put me that way and said, well, go and speak to someone about it. Or he'd just say things to snap you out of it, and you go, you know, I spend a lot of time in a bedsit in Hackney, you know, it's my friends are an hour away or whatever like that, and you're on your own, and so I'd be there all week and weekends because I'd be working, whatever like that. You know, he'd put you in perspective and say, well, it's not that bad, is it? You know what I mean? Just take your head out your ass sometimes, I suppose. But yeah,
and because it did seem for a while as well like he was grooming you to be his number two, right? You were doing corners with him.
Yeah, I did Frotch corner for Pascal. We went to America, LA. I did all of them. Lenny Dawes fought Jason Cook, one of loads of them. And like I say, at the time, I was I loved boxing.
So was that your call to not do that any longer, or did you guys?
No, not at all. Not. It was a case of retired, and I met my wife within a month. Still spoke to him after I retired. And at one point, he asked me to come back on board when probably the AJ thing was coming. But I have two kids to feed, and I can't be away for 6 weeks or 7 weeks or whatever like that. So,
and I suppose you can't have a job where the income fluctuates from camp to camp, right? You've got to know what's coming in.
I mean, I'm sure Robert would have sorted something out that way. I've got no doubt of that. But I think it's time-wise. I think I wanted to be out of home, so it was the case that way.
You mentioned that Pascal fight. I think Tyson Fury made his debut on that bill. What was your first encounter with Fury?
My first encounter with him was in Watford. He fought on a show in Watford for Mickey. Matthew Furr was fighting. And I was like, wow, where's this kid come from? He reminded me, he was like a white Riddick Bowe.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He could fight inside, and his ring savvy was... Yeah, you could see there's something about him, definitely.
Yeah, because there was a story. Did you hear that story about him sparring that Mike Perez out in Dublin? Do you remember that?
Yes, yeah, because I think Mickey
Rob was out there. Yeah, Rob and Mick were out there, right?
Yeah. I think there was a story. He handed the...
This fear right, Cuban, he was... Yeah. He was... I think they were having trouble sparring him, and Fury goes out there as an amateur. I don't think he turned pro yet. And instantly, I think Mick and Rob, possibly Rob, definitely Mick, were incredibly harming, weren't they? That was the story. I remember that during the rounds. Mm. Do you remember actually that Perez fighting in the Real Fight Club?
I do remember him.
And he was there with that Luis Garcia, wasn't he?
I do remember him there.
They were weapons, weren't they?
Yeah, tough kids. You could see there was something about them, like. But the crackers, aren't they? Do you know what I mean? The crackers, because they're coming, obviously, coming from Cuba, and everything's set in stone over there and whatever, and they come out here and west and they'll just go mad, don't they?
Yeah, for the freedom.
For women
them,
and stuff
it?
Like that, and they just go mad.
I remember that Luis Garcia, I saw him box Tony Salam over there at the Real Fight Club, and I was like, I think I wrote a hot prospect piece saying, like, go out and grab your kids' education fund and stick it on him to be a world champion.
Yeah.
He had about three more fights and went away, so I hope no one actually did it.
But that's the game, innit? Because like we said before, boxing is more mainly about what you don't do in the gym and what you do in the gym.
Yeah, true. They're good examples. It's also another example of, doesn't matter how much talent you've got if you're not going to apply it.
That's it. Apply yourself, you find it. Your level eventually.
So you said about the Thaxton fight. So I spoke to Jono recently, and I think he said that was the best fight of his career.
Oh, there was nothing stopping him that night. Nothing. I mean...
But does that mean it was the worst night of your career?
It's probably not the best. I took a lot of punishment. It was one of them. I'd won the title in May. I was supposed to fight in September because he was mandatory straight away. Because obviously he was number one, and me and David fought for the vacant. So he was my mandatory straight away. So we had to fight him, which I had no qualms about fighting him. It just gone from September to October to November and got put back, and it ended up being December. And at the time, I was travelling at home the weekends. And listen, I'm not making any excuses. That was Faxon's night to be a British champion. I'd done behind the two previous times. He lost to Rollins over a cut, and then lost on a points decision to Hatton. These both at light welterweight. That was his moment. So, like we said before, you get what you deserve in boxing.
But did you deserve that then? It's one thing.
Well,
he
it was my it. Level. It was probably that was my standard. You know, that was probably my pinnacle as such. You know,
that's not a bad thing, though, is it? That's probably why you can say it that way, right?
Yeah. Listen, there's things I could have done better without a shadow. I could have been probably tried to make super featherweight a little bit more diligent with training and dieting and. We all could have done a lot.
But it's a pretty rough first defence as well, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a big
In terms of your, you know, when you get the belt, you think, bank a voluntary and all the rest of it. But it wasn't like that, was
that's
it?
That's it, no. It was one of them. That was a... I think I'd it was an eliminator stage. I was supposed to fight David Burke and he'd pull out, which was probably in my favour because he was decent. And then Danny Hunt was, or Peter McDonough was supposed to fight Dave Stewart and they pulled out, so we ended up me and Dave. But I think it was the case that Graham Earle had had to vacate. Dave was going to stick to one side because Tony and Mickey were quite pals.
Tony Sims.
Yeah. So then I would have been voluntary number one for Graham Earle, but he vacated. And that's when the title come available for me and Dave to fight like.
You would have liked the Earle fight, wouldn't you?
So
you would have liked the Graham Earle fight.
Yeah, I'd sparred him previous, and I thought I could have done all right against him.
Yeah.
And that was when Dean Powell was there, and it was just a case of, oh, do you want to spar with you? And I don't think it was full-time with Robert at the time. Don't get me wrong, he was a good fighter, and obviously fighting's a lot different to sparring, without a doubt. Probably similar sort of fighters. But yeah, it would have been a good fight.
Definitely. Well, he had that fight of the year tear-up as well, didn't he, with Katsidis?
Yeah, and he was good fighters as well, weren't they? Good punch. He was definitely punchers. But yeah, no. Listen, we can all look back and say we could have, would have, should have, couldn't you?
But, I mean, you did. You could say that, but British champion, and then obviously you lose that to Thaxton, but then you also get the opportunity to go out to Vegas and live the dream in that respect, right?
Yeah, I mean...
So, am I right in just... Because I'm using memory a little bit here, but was this the night before Hatton Mayweather?
Yes, it was.
And so it was like a UK-US themed thing.
Yeah.
And you and John Murray were both on it.
Me, John Murray.
Carl Dargan was on it.
Craig McEwen, a Scottish kid who boxed out in Vegas. There was a few other kids. Yeah, but Robert didn't want me. I'd boxed a Polish kid, I think it was, in Doncaster. And I boxed really well. And Robert said, right, I don't want... And I was... At the time, I was still working, training. And he said, I don't want you to go to Vegas. He said, I don't think you're right. I said, I've got to. I said, I've got... My uncle, who's already paid for tickets and flights. My mate sold his car to come out there. I said, I've got to go. I said, He said, but I can't go then. He said, I've got to do this. And I went, all right, well, Matthew will come out and do the corner. Matthew did the corner for us.
Oh, well.
Yeah. And it was a great experience. You'd fight anyone to go fight on that bill, and it was good. And when we got out there, and you're on MGM Grand, and you've got your name on it, and you're like, wow. But I'm walking down, I'm looking at this pictures of it. Obviously, they're advertising it on the scoreboard or whatever it is. And it's a picture of Lenny Dawes and my name. So I ring Mickey up and I said, Mick, I said, thanks for doing all this and all that. I said, but you've got my name's on lights on a billboard in Vegas. I said, but it's a picture of Lenny Dawes. So
that's hilarious.
So Mickey said he reckons they were waiting for some big good looking fucker to get off the plane instead of you. Like, well, yeah.
That's funny. And Lenny's a guy that we should have mentioned, actually, because I'm guessing you did a load of rounds with him as well, right?
Yeah.
Because he was in and around that stage.
Good fighter. Real good fighter. And his levels of fitness was unreal.
Yeah.
Unreal. And I think, Lenny turned it for me in how you prepare and the look you get from life and anything. We went to Darlington, and saying about doing the corners and stuff, and... I did the corner when Lenny fought Oscar Hall. This was for an eliminator for the British title. And Lenny got cut over both eyes. It was close. And he won the fight by points. And Oscar Hall was in his home turn. It could have easily gone the other way. Not the fight could have gone the other way. It could have got stopped or whatever, like, home crowd decision. And it didn't. And that just epitomised what Lenny was about and working hard. And he made his own luck and he was a good fighter. Good fighter, and I thought he should have won it outright after looking at some of the fights he fought against Theo Payne and Jason Cook. I think he was unlucky, definitely.
By the way, you and Frotch, obviously we talked about obviously you being in his corner. What were you like when you were stable mates? Did you get close to him, or was he?
Yeah, he was good pals with Carl. Yeah. He's all right. Yeah, he's a his sense of humour. It's some people just don't get. That's all it is. And he can come across a little bit big-headed and stuff like that, but I don't think he is. I think he just winds people up.
It's dry humour.
Yeah, really. I call him, he's like David Brent. You know, he's a, He's all right. He's a nice kid.
It's amazing though, because when you say obviously about Lenny and it, you know, showing about the hard work, you know, Froch was toiling away in that real fight.
Oh,
though,
no,
wasn't
he? He was a different, you know, animal totally.
And but like you, you know, going down there, sacrificing, being away, because back then, you know, he wasn't having the big fights and he hadn't become a big name. But you've got to put that kind of commitment in to get the dividends.
God, yeah.
Down the end, right?
Oh no, he was diligent as they come, without a doubt. I think it, with Carl, I think it was probably mental more than anything. And obviously, that's where Robert come on board with him. Like he shaped him that way, you know, to believe that, you know, he was indestructible. And he was, pretty much.
And I know there were high hopes for him, right? And I always knew that, you know, Mick thought he could get there. But did you, with what you saw, did you think he would go on to achieve what he has?
God, yeah. You'd see him fight. You'd see him fight and you think, sparring, you just see...
He was horrible, wasn't he?
Yeah. You could just see he was going to grind him down and irrelevant of what... And he could box. And he, you know, gives himself a bit of a bad name saying he couldn't punch, he couldn't box or whatever. But you don't get a world bronze if you can't box. You know, he had a good IQ and he had great timing. Great timing and good long arms.
Great engine.
Yeah, and he'd lose weight out of training. Yeah. What fighter loses weight out of training? It just don't happen. And he was... That makes it enjoyment.
Yeah, I was talking to someone about body types the other day and, you know, Carl's got one of those body types that's... Basically, he's going to be 12 stone from the age of 18 to 80. 100%.
Well, his dad's parents are Eastern European. You know, he's Polish origin, you know. And you can see that in it's all genetics, in it.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
And then you've got other guys that, you know, that are toiling to keep their weight down.
God, yeah.
You know, like your Alex Arthur's fighting to...
Oh, God. Know, Alex was massive.
And now he's a tank.
Yeah. Oh, no, he just pile it on, don't they?
But it's difficult though, because obviously I'm guessing it's not easy to be 9 stone 9 stone 9 when you're 28 years old, 29 years old.
No, and I never struggled. For years I was all right, and I never used to be that bad. It was always as you get to 28 year old 9 stone 9 people. Do you know? You don't know that many, do you? You know what I mean? So there's not many of them about. So to try and take it off all the time, it's but that's the life of a fighter, isn't it?
Was there a particular time where you found it really hard to shift? And was it, I guess, later in your career?
Later on in the career, but then I did toy with dropping down to super heavyweight. I thought, well, I'll try and... I think it might have been the one out in Vegas. I thought I'll try, but then I just couldn't do it. It was just... I think I was running quite a lot and I'll try and... But it just doesn't happen sometimes.
What was the rest of the Vegas trip like and the Vegas fight and stuff? Was that
It was good. We went to Johnny Tocco's and went to the gym. Me and Matthew was out there. It was good. Obviously, Joe Gallagher was out there with John Murray. And then my family, well, some of my family, my uncle and my friends come out there. And it was good.
Was it a good thing to tick off the bucket list?
Oh, without a doubt.
Did you get a shot of your name with Lenny Dawes' picture? And have you got a picture of it anyway?
We got it transferred, the picture, eventually. But I don't know what picture it was, like, I'll be honest. But I think I might have got it somewhere.
They probably put Dave Walker's up there.
Yeah, probably. Hopefully, because Dave's not a bad-looking fella, to be honest. You know. But, yeah.
So when you get... Obviously, well, you say about John Murray there, actually. Obviously, John was your next opponent. Did you spend any time with him out in Vegas?
Yeah. I'd sparred hundreds and hundreds of rounds with John.
Where did you do that there? At Joe's?
Done it at Champs Camp, firstly. Yeah. Because Mickey, he was with Steve Wood at the time. And then Mickey Hennessy obviously signed him. And he was used on a few shows we had. And he said he was struggling with sparring. I went up there and it was like a force of nature, without a doubt. And it took me by surprise, and we had a right at the time. It went off in the Champs Camp. It was a good spar, and he was definitely a force of nature. Like,
is there anyone that stands out as the best person that you sparred? Gave you the most trouble?
All of them, to be honest with you. John Murray was a fantastic fan. I think I 100% think if he'd have had the diligence, he would have gone on to win a world title. But I think the best fighter I've sparred in the gym was probably John O'Donnell. John O'Donnell was, he'd hit you with about 10 shots, and he was like Michael Nunn. He was Really good, really good. But it's a 12-round fight, and he didn't grab that whack to
keep people
up. Yeah. But great fighter. Great fighter. Great kid.
With regards to John, obviously people might not know, but John was being sort of set up to be the next Ricky Hatton at the time, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. And you can see why. You can see why. Like I say, I spent hundreds of rounds with him. Hundreds of rounds. And he was a lovely kid as well. But he'll tell you himself, he could have done a lot better in his out of training appearances, like, but yeah.
You only get one shot.
You do, yeah. But that's life, innit?
So you ended up fighting John. So did you have any? Were you confident going into your fight with John?
Yeah, yeah. You always sort of back yourself, don't you? And I prepared really good for it. But it was a case of what was left from the Faxon fight, because, you know, it was a tough, grueling fight. 12 rounds. I lost on points, but I took some heavy shots and Faxon. I think he knocked all his, when he won the title, he won it outright and knocked them all out, didn't he? Lawton and all them, they all got folded within four Dave or five rounds.
Well. Dave went late, didn't he?
Dave took him late, fight. Didn't he? In fact, I thought Dave was winning, to be honest with you. And then he just got caught. But yeah, at lightweight, he was thingy. So, but yeah, it just took too much out of me.
Because right around this time, you're one who's in a bit of a sweepstakes for Amir Khan, aren't you, as well?
Well, I got offered the fight. Before he fought Gomez, I got offered the fight.
He fought Gomez in Birmingham, right, I think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So I said, yeah, we'll take it. I think at lightweight, I probably could have got closer to him, but obviously he's a different level at lightweight. I think he struggled at lightweight. That's why he got put over by Gomez and... That, what was the...
William Lemond.
Prescott and stuff, yeah. Prescott, yeah. But yeah. We'd have took it, but they ended up going with Gomez.
So what happened? So why didn't you get that one?
They went with Gomez instead.
Okay. So you said yes, Gomez said yes, and they just went with Gomez.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Pretty much.
Was that... Did you think it would come back to you? You get offered it again down the line?
Yeah, I thought so. But obviously at the time, I was with Mickey and they was... Obviously it was with Warren. But I think he sort of stayed clear because I thought... He should have fought Faxon, really.
Yeah.
He should have fought Faxon. Faxon would have iced him, without a doubt.
Do you reckon? So I was talking to Jono about this the other day. So it's interesting you say that, because obviously it was Jono's experience and power, and possibly timing, against Khan's speed and youth and ambition, I guess. And you can't, because the way that Khan could outbox people and use his speed.
Oh no, he definitely.
There's a good shot. He could have.
Oh, he'd give Faxon problems all day long. But I'm not saying that.
It could be a 120, 108 fight in Khan's favour, but he could also get chinned in two rounds.
I just think pro boxing's, especially 12 round fights, it slows down after 5-6 rounds.
Mm-hmm.
So him jumping about and being all that, he's going to get caught at some point, and he's going to get hurt. So I think the Faxon who I fought, I think he would have beat any of them.
Did you ever spar Gomez?
No.
And not Khan either?
No, never sparred Khan. Like I said, I turned pro. I left home at 19, so I spent a lot of time away from Manchester and Salford and that. Done bits. I know Thomas, obviously know Thomas from fighting when he was a kid, like, him and his brother, like, Collier's, Brian Hughes and all them. I actually boxed a kid from Collier's. I can't remember his name. I got stopped. I think he was in his junior ABAs. He got my first introduction to body shots. And
oh, really?
Yeah, and I didn't know what the hell it was. I was only 15. Like, fuck's sake. But, there was just some good fighters up here. Tommy was a good kid.
So you said, obviously, about your passion for boxing. I do remember that from when we used to spend some time back in the day. Like, you were a student of the sport. Were you like that as a teenager and as a kid?
No, it was I sort of toyed with it, really, at the time, messing about with it. And it, like I say, I boxed a couple of times in Jersey because my uncle was fighting at the time. And he used to get me to the fight out there. And it was just a case of when I got out there, I didn't know anyone, so I just trained, and then after that it was just spiraled from there, really.
So did you go back and watch fights of all the greats and stuff as well when you started to get into it properly?
I liked the old school, yeah. That's all I used to like. The modern day ones, I don't like certain ones stand out for me, but
who were the ones that you kind of like did like to watch? If you were chucking a couple of names in YouTube,
I loved Holyfield. I thought he was a great fighter. Holyfield, Aguero, Chavez, just good fighters, you know. De La Hoya, loved De La Hoya. I think he was a fantastic fighter.
Yeah, real, for everybody, as
real
well.
Good fighter, real good fighter. And I think a lot of that. Obviously, he's a bit of a clown now, but. He's a fantastic fighter.
You can't dispute what he did in his career, though, can you?
Not at all.
So was Khan? Was Khan the one that got away for you?
Not really. Listen, his career. He's a better fighter than me. There's no two ways.
No, but it would be nice for you know.
Oh, do that a day. Yeah, boxing. Yeah. I think at lightweight, I think I probably could have given him a few trouble.
If you could have boxed anyone, was it him? Is that the one that was missing off your record? You're given that you fought John Jono. Or is there anyone else that you would have liked?
I would have liked the Earl fight. I would have liked that Earl fight.
Yeah.
Other than that, not really, no. Took enough hiding.
So, mate, you say that, but you were useful. I think you're downplaying it.
Yeah, no, I'm only messing. Like, yeah, of course, you back yourself against anyone, don't you, boys? So you got to have a bit of a tongue-in-cheek.
And then you have said a couple of times, like, how much the Thaxton fight took out of you. So was that, are you referring physically, emotionally, like, and was it to the point where it actually changed brain scans and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think it, fights like that, don't they change your career, without a doubt. Mentally, yeah. Physically, probably as well, yeah. It's, and don't get me wrong, I probably wouldn't have had enough for Murray anyway. I think for that fight, I think I've spoke to him a few times about it, and he'll say himself he's never prepared for a fight more than that fight because we'd sparred loads of rounds. But I still don't think it probably would have beat him. You got to look back with a bit of... You can always look back at the rose-tinted glasses, can't you? I think I could have done that, I would have done it. It doesn't work like that, does it? John was maybe about 4 or 5 inches bigger than me, 4 or 5 inches wider than me, you know, and he had a tremendous work rate.
Yeah, and he had that sort of... I know it's cliche, but he had the eye of the tiger when he fought. Oh, God.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Zoned in.
Yeah, he was zoned in, without a doubt. Like, he'll tell you yourself, anyone who's seen us at spa, we're hammering tongues like.
So, but in terms of the Thaxton fight, and apologies for drilling deep in this, but obviously, Jono said it was the one that, you know, he stood out as his best performance.
Oh, God, yeah.
And in terms of, for you, in terms of you saying, because it's, you know, people have more than one hard fight in them and say, you know, oh yeah, maybe after 3, 4, 5, yeah. Like, that's your one where it was that bad.
Yeah.
And you're like, so how bad was it like in the subsequent days after that fight? Was it sort of thing where you're bedbound for a couple of days?
I don't think it was bedbound. I can't remember. You're just distraught from it. I mean, what you got to take into consideration is that I got to 2 ABA finals.
Yeah.
Lost. And then I fought for English title, lost. And then I'm fighting for the British title, and I won the British title. And you're searching for that label, and you're that clause or whatever it is. And all of a sudden I had it, and it was different. You know, I went from one level to probably jumped to about 2 or 3 different levels. And it was just not to be, and it took everything away from me as a fighter, mentally, and whether to get prepared. You're at the top of Everest, and all of a sudden you're back in the base camp. So it was one of them. He took everything out of me, as mentally, and it was a tough fight because he's a good fighter and he could whack. And I will never forget it being the scales, and I thought, "Oh, what am I scared?" And I weren't scared, but I thought it was nothing of him. It was nothing, and he was a little small. And I thought there's nothing of him. And I remember walking to the ring, looking in the ring. And I thought, who's he? That's a different fellow. And he was, because he had his big chest, he's only short, but big chest, big arms. And I thought, who the fucking hell is this fellow? It's not the same fellow I seen yesterday. So I said to Robert, I went, size of him. And he went, I know. Good luck. See you later. And don't want it. So it was.
Even 12 rounds.
Yes, even 12 rounds. But yeah, and that was his night. And like we said before, you get what's coming to you.
And your night was the Dave Stewart fight.
Definitely, yeah. And Dave's a good fighter, really good fighter, you know, really good fighter. And I watched the Vanzi fight, it could have been 44 rounds, never mind 4 rounds, do you know what I mean? He's a good fighter.
Did you get offers to fight on, or did you just make it known to Mick, you said, that's it, I'm done?
Robert said to me, I'll never forget, and got back in the changing rooms, and, you know, it was what it was. It's like your timing's not there, and your distance, and just thought, well, I'm just going to have to go for it and see where I'm at. And I got back in the changing room and went, oh, well, you've had a good career. So that was to me that, right, that's it. So if Robert had said, all right, we'll knock down and we'll go again, then I know that's a difference in the coaches and trainers and people like Robert. You know, they know what to say, know when to say it, and they know from experience what they're saying.
But also there's a massive difference there, though, Lee, in terms of relationships. And this happens when you respect your coach.
Yeah.
And you don't surround yourselves with people who tell you what you want to hear. And Robert didn't tell you what you wanted to hear, but he told you what you needed to hear.
Yeah. It was a kind of, well, you know, you've had a good career. And this was all like all around us. You know, he's not seeing me one by side by side. And that was all I needed to hear. I mean, I didn't need to hear it because I knew. I just knew because it's like I said before. It's tough when you're good. Never mind when you're failing and you're not at the races.
Because I think I wrote the preview for your fight with John Murray, and it was about. I seem to remember being a bit thinking it was close to a 50-50. I think you were perhaps his big step up.
Yeah,
and you were probably, with all due respect, you were his Charlie Shepherd, right?
100%.
And that's the cycle of boxing.
Without a shadow. I mean, I didn't have the career that Shepherd had, but, you know, I was stable, mate. You know, I could fight. And John was destined to bigger things, without a doubt.
So, you know, I go back to the Lee that I knew back from the Real Fight Club, and I remember you going to, you know, being into the boxing news and all the rest of it. Are you still passionate about the sport now? Or are you like
a peripheral? I don't have time, to be honest with you. Certain ones pick out some fighters, and I think I like the look of him, but I don't really look at it. It's a lot of fighters look at it. Certain fighters, some of the trainers, just it sort of irritates me. I'll be honest with you, trainers and the way the trash talk, and I'm very old school and how it should be done. And obviously, it's about money now, isn't it? It's not about the reputation. And you got YouTubers and cricket players and, you know, all sorts of fighting.
Were you, knowing Rob the way that you did, were you surprised at him and Joshua's parting company?
I don't know what's gone on, to be honest with you. I think Joshua knew Robert was the best, and that's why he's always been with him. Like, it's been a case, whether he's failed, whether Joshua's got too much money and, you know, people not doing as he's told, and I don't know.
It's the old haggler sleeping in silk.
Yeah, it's a tough one, and it's easy for us all to say that. I mean, the times I've seen Robert and Joshua's been there, he's been a gentleman, like, you know, he's nice, seemed a nice kid. But you don't know people, do you?
Yeah, we can't say what we'd be like if we woke up with tens of millions in the bank.
That's it. And fighting's hard. Heavyweight fighting, it's a hard sport. Do I think he could have done better? Of course, but couldn't we all?
I was going to say, who couldn't? In terms of you and Rob, are you still tight?
Yeah. I'll be honest with you, I should ring him a lot more. Reason being, I never know when to ring him, to be honest with you. He's either been, I don't know, he's here, there and everywhere, isn't he, you know?
And what about Mick? Are you still?
I've not spoken to Mick for a good while, no. It's a shame, like, no way.
What about any of the old guys? So, obviously, you said at the top before we started recording that you're still in touch with Thirlwell.
Yeah.
What about Dave Walker, Lenny Dawes, any of that?
Lenny Dawes, I've not seen Lenny for a good while. Dave, I saw at a funeral, a good mate of ours, in February. So, Dave seems to be doing all right. It looks all right.
Did you get to know Darren Sutherland, by the way, at all down there?
I don't know. I didn't. No. Matthew did a bit with him. Yes. I think Matthew did a little bit with him. But Matthew was in around the same age, and they went to the World Games when did he get a silver, Darren?
Yes.
So he knew him, but I didn't really know him. I knew Brian was training him at the time. But yeah, no, I didn't really know him.
So when you jacked in, what was your thoughts? Were you like, well, that was a good run, or that was a lot of fun? Or
yeah, it was a case of, I don't know, what's next? You know, you can't, I don't know, it's one of them, isn't it? Life moves on, doesn't it? You just got to keep going.
But it was mission accomplished, though, wasn't it?
Oh, God, yeah. British style. No matter what anyone says, they can't take that away from me. Like, so it's something I'd always planned out to do, and it was a great ride. Great ride. Met some great people. Real good people.
And although you didn't get your face up in lights, you got your name up.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. I've never heard of anything like that
before. I know, it's crazy. I think Mick did it on purpose, to be honest with you. I wish he'd put someone better looking, though, to be honest. Yeah.
Sabotaged it.
Yeah.
Oh, mate. Well, look, thank you so much for coming over, Lee. Really appreciate it.
No, thanks for remembering me. This is something, mate. You know, this is something fighters love, you know what I mean? Because life moves so fast and you think your career's gone, and it's nice to refresh and go over it again, I suppose.
Well, those years when we were in the Royal Fight Club, 15 years ago now.
I know.
14, 15 years ago.
I know, it's crazy. Time waits for no one, does it?
Yeah, but I'm glad, you know, I always find that the guys who transition into work and careers and family are the guys that are the most content. And like you said, we all have our issues, we all have our crosses to bear, and probably we all have our down days. But there's probably nothing worse than floating around wondering what went wrong and thinking that, you know, you've got nothing to do.
You just got to be, I don't know what it sounds saying, you shouldn't really say it, but you've got to be a man about it or not have an ego and move on. You've got kids to feed or whatever like that. You just, life moves on. No point dining out in the past.
Well, have you ever had that thing where someone's said, what are you doing tarmacking? Like, you were on TV the other day. Because I remember Wayne Elcock saying that when he was doing work for BT, like doing the rigging and that.
Well,
and they'd be like, you were fighting on telly on Saturday. What are you doing here?
Well, when I come back, I retired. I was working on the roles in London, and then I moved back and I was doing a house up. And my wife got pregnant at the time, and I didn't have a job. And I didn't know anyone in the area, you know, doing the tarmacking up here, because I was London-based. And I went to sign on a dole. And as I'm sat there waiting, people have to do it. It is what it is, but it's not the nicest thing to do, it's, you know what I mean?
Sober and tired.
Yeah. Of course, it's like, Jesus. And I'm sat there, and the lad next to me just said, all right, Lee, how are you doing? He says, you don't remember me, do you? I'm like, I seen you fight on the other day. I was like, oh, of all the time I need to see someone I know, I'm fucking signing on the dole. But it was one of them, and you just get on with it. You just bite on your gum shield or so and keep moving, can't you?
Yeah, definitely. But, I mean, like I said, it might be, we've all had rocky spells, but like the thing is now you've got the routine. You got
that's all life's about, routine, work and routine. Because if you've not got it, you go all over the place, don't you?
And do you know Mickey Ward does the same thing, right?
What? Tarmac? Does he really? Yeah.
Right, so Mickey Ward, right, who's obviously had this trilogy with Arturo Gatti and boxed Emmanuel Burton, Shane Neary and all the rest of it. He's had the fighter done on his life.
Yeah.
He's started being a tarmac all the way through.
Yeah. There's a few. I think...
As in, even to this day, he still does it now.
Does it really? Yeah. Oh, good. It's a good industry, mate.
There's a story he's told me on this podcast before, holding that very microphone.
Right.
In his house in Lowell in Boston, on the outskirts of Boston. And there's a thing that they use, a dampener. Do you know what that, like a dampener, a bit like a rake, with a flat rake, and when he's tarmac and he's putting the rake through things.
Right,
there's a story, and it was in his book, and I thought, where I'd known him well, he told me, you know, all the good stories there were.
Yeah.
And I'd read it in his book before we did the podcast, and there was this rake that someone had been doing this, that, and the other with, and he'd been up in the cab of this roller, I guess, and he jumps out of the roller, and there's no nice way to say this, but the rake went right up his rectum.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
And he nearly killed himself.
Wow.
And so you can go back in the Boxing Life Stories archives and pick out the Mickey Ward episode.
Right.
And hear about how he impaled himself as a...
Jesus Christ. I don't know how he's done that. It's a million to one shot,
isn't it?
Yeah. Sounds like to me he's planted it there, to be honest with you.
You couldn't do it if you planned it, I'm sure.
He's probably Vaseline'd it up beforehand. Don't worry about that.
He was inches from death. Wow. And he was good on the podcast about it, but he's got a book called, but it's his autobiography. There's a couple of Mickey Ward books, but it's only in his autobiography. And it's really, he's very graphic about it. Yeah. So be careful out there, Leo.
Yeah. Well, I try not to get involved anymore. I just just point my finger and say, you do that over there.
I wouldn't even put your finger out.
Mind you, I'm that small, to be honest with you. The rake would have to be like a child's one or something like that.
Oh, dear. But, mate, well, thank you so much. It's really good to connect with you after all this time, mate.
No worries, mate. You too. Cheers, mate.
So really good, interesting stuff from Lee. I know one of the things people like about this podcast is the honesty that the fighters express, and it doesn't get much more nice and pleasant and honest than that from Lee. Good fighter, really nice guy, good honest pro, good hardworking man, and it's a pleasure to know him. It was also good to cover his career. He was in some great scraps, and I will always remember those days of the Alan Lacey Real Fight Club fondly, where there was a hub of incredible talent for a short space of time. Guys, if you are enjoying Boxing Life Stories, please jump over to iTunes and give us a rate and review. It's hugely appreciated. Astonishingly, I checked it out the other day, we are approaching 1,500 reviews on iTunes, which is staggering for little old me. I'm blown away by the reviews that have been left. And if you are enjoying it, please jump on there and give us a 5-star review if you think it's worth it. Huge thanks also, not just to those who rate and review, but to my sponsors, as always, Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but they help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance, and they are a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide. And they provide expert impartial advice on all aspects of fire, health and safety compliance. And you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. If you do want to support the podcast, you can jump on to patreon.com/TrisDixon and support Boxing Life Stories for as little as £5 a month. It does make a huge difference as to what I'm trying to achieve with the podcast, and I do appreciate it enormously. You do get bonus material up there. I'm putting up a video each week with my thoughts on the latest ongoings in boxing, or goings on should it be, in boxing. And there's early episodes in advance with the likes of Sam Sexton, Danny McIntosh and American matchmaker Eric Botcher. Guys, this has been brilliant. Thank you very much to Lee Meager for being part of Boxing Life Stories, and thank you very much to you guys for listening, and we'll be back next week.